Well, a couple of introductory remarks. If you heard a lot of screaming and screeching from back there, not to be afraid. There was a mouse that invaded.
I don't think so.
And there are certain members of the court who are very anti-mouse, and when they see the screaming was nothing of concern. And
the mouse is I misidentified.
I think so. Just saying.
Yeah. Okay, so getting on to other things that are of more merit at the moment. My notes tell me that Platteville High School is here, and if students are here from Platteville, will they please? Oh, wow, wonderful. Please be seated. That's a great group. Well, the students are here on a program called Chord with Class, and we operate that in conjunction with. So they will know a little bit about the case that you're going to argue to us today. And students, if you can stay after this argument is over, Justice Rebecca Dalek down here at the end will come down and chat with you a little bit about how cases get to the Supreme Court. She won't talk about the substance of the case we're about to hear, but there are a lot of things that I'm sure she can tell you that you'll find of interest. So if you can stay, please do. And now for our second case, Landglade County versus DJW. Counsel, are you prepared to begin? Please do so.
Nice tie, by the way, counsel. Well done.
Thank you. Your Honor?
Please begin.
Thank you. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I am Assistant State Public Defender Jeremy Newman, and I represent DJW, or David, as he has been referred to in the briefs. The principle at the heart of this case is that mental illness alone does not make someone dangerous. That principle is embodied in the constitutional requirement that to involuntarily commit someone, the government must prove, by clear and convincing evidence, that they are both mentally ill and dangerous. So as relevant here, Wisconsin Statute Sections 51.20, sub 1A2D, and sub 1AM set forth the applicable statutory standards of dangerousness. The issue presented here is simple and rather unique. Where the only evidence of David's alleged dangerousness was a doctor's testimony that David is unable to care for himself, as evidenced by 1, his loss of employment, 2, his receipt of disability benefits, and 3, his reliance on his family for housing, the county failed to meet its evidentiary burden, and the circuit court's order extending David's commitment was erroneous.
Dangerousness doesn't just mean a threat of physical violence to others or even a threat to oneself, right? It's more than that under the statute, and you're not challenging the constitutionality of the statute, are you?
No, I am not, Your Honor, and the court is aware that the statute 5120 includes numerous subsections, 5 subsections specifically that apply directly to an initial commitment, and then a separate subsection 1AM that applies to an extension or a recommitment like this. And they include both danger to others, danger to self, including violence or threats of violence, which was discussed in the previous case, and then also danger to self, essentially based on mental illness. And the statute, each specific subsection has its own definition and requirements on how, if the county wants to involuntarily commit someone because they're mentally ill and alleged to be dangerous, they have to meet those statutory standards that, that give a legal definition to dangerousness.
Why doesn't this case fit under sub E?
So that's an interesting question. First, because this has never been a fifth standard case. Sub E is the fifth standard, the last standard listed in sub 5120. But this case has never been a fifth standard case. It wasn't alleged by the county, either in the original commitment or in this extension, as a fifth standard case that it was dangerous to himself under the fifth standard. And that's relevant because this fifth standard, for whatever specific reason, the legislature decided to add these requirements, but there are special pleading requirements that apply only to the fifth standard. And those are set forth, the one I'm referring to is in 51.20 sub 10 CM, which if the county proposes to commit somebody involuntarily because they're dangerous under the fifth standard, they have to, you know, the statute, it's 20 or so lines long about the treatment plan and the specifics about what this commitment is going to look like under the fifth standard. So that was never done in this case, and it has never been argued at the circuit court level, in the Court of Appeals, or here as a fifth standard case.
Do you think the Court of Appeals seemed to rely on sub E?
I don't think so. I think the Court of Appeals decision is rather unclear whether it relied on any standard. I think that's part of the problem. This case, it was addressed, you know, that issue was addressed in our briefs, or in my brief, at least, in terms of what the fifth standard, what the recommitment standard requires. And I think this court said just recently, just this past spring or summer, that there's a different alternative evidentiary path, is I believe the term the court used, to recommit somebody under Chapter 51. That's slightly different because we don't require recent acts, but otherwise the court was very clear that that the statute still requires the same elements, the same burden of proof, and you still have to prove that somebody is currently dangerous. It's not this sort of undefined proper subject for commitment. So yeah, I think that's I can't exactly explain the entire basis for the Court of Appeals decision. I think ultimately they just affirm the circuit court's legal conclusion that there was enough evidence on dangerousness, but the circuit court didn't go on, didn't explain that, and the real issue that I've raised in the briefs, I think the heart of this case is that whatever the doctor said or didn't say, the issue is what the actual evidence shows and what his testimony did show about why he thought David was dangerous. And it's not simply enough to say, either for the doctor or a court, just conclude or find that somebody who's mentally ill is dangerous. There's got to be more than that, and that's what the statute
contemplates. Is there anything that would prohibit this court from looking at the record and using the evidence that was presented, concluding that sub E would apply and concluding that David is dangerous under sub E, or was at the time?
I mean, honestly, I think it would be difficult for this court to affirm a commitment. And so in addition to the pleading requirements that Chapter 51 has for the fifth standard petitions and cases, Chapter 51.20 sub 13 G2D limits the actual commitment to specifically under the fifth standard, unlike any of the other four standards or a recommitment, that it can only, you know, it's limited to 30 days of inpatient treatment. And that definitely was not what the court found, and it's not what the court order in this case says on the, you know, the forms that were used. The form that was used specifically excludes the fifth standard. So it's difficult to, it's difficult, and I don't think it would be the right thing for this court to affirm David's commitment in this case from one, evidence that wasn't presented that meets the fifth standard, and then two, sort of uphold his commitment because it arguably or theoretically could have met the fifth standard or might have been a fifth standard case, but just wasn't and isn't. So I don't think that the court can or should do that. I guess moving to maybe the heart of the issue, I'm not conceding, and I would argue, and it's a little tough when it wasn't raised in the briefs at any point up until now to fully address that. It's been argued pretty specifically under this recommitment standard and sub 2D, the danger to self because of an inability to care for oneself. So I don't think the fifth standard applies to this case, or I don't think that's a basis to uphold it.
So the argument that's made here that it is met under D is that because he lives with his parents, because he's on disability, the things you said, how do you overcome those factual findings that are true, that he is going to have to live with his parents, that he can't work, and that he's getting disability? How come that doesn't meet the standard in sub D of being unable to take care of himself?
Sure. I just to clarify, I don't know that it's the focus of this case, or what I want to spend a lot of time arguing about, but the doctor testified to those things, and we're not specifically contesting his testimony about those facts or allegations, whatever we want to call them. The court did not make any findings related to those facts and how they meet the legal standard. I think that's, you know, so that's the ultimate issue here. So I would take those facts, his loss of employment, which the doctor testified was based on his, or it was because he was suffering from these delusions, and he couldn't work, so he quit a job. He also, because of his mental illness, obtained on his own disability benefits so that, you know, to deal with the fact that he couldn't work full-time or even couldn't work at all, let's just say. He obtained disability benefits just like anybody else who's entitled to them or eligible for them, you know, would or should do to be able to meet his basic needs. And then the last thing is the fact that he lived with his family, and the doctor made this leap that he would be homeless but for his willing and able support from his family. So those are the facts that we're talking about. And I think you take those facts and then you apply them to the fourth standard, which I think the only thing that's met here is that there is behavior due to a mental illness that something happened. And then I think that's where the county's evidence fails in this case, that he is unable to satisfy his basic needs for nourishment, medical care, shelter, or safety without prompt and adequate treatment. So I think my view, and I think a reasonable view of Dr. Coates' testimony, is that David is able to satisfy his basic needs, you know, his basic human needs for shelter and nourishment. I don't know that he said anything about medical care or safety, but he is able to meet those basic needs. So this isn't a case, and I can imagine a number of scenarios where a doctor might testify that because of somebody's mental illness, which is severe, you know, maybe it's, you know, schizophrenia like it is in this case, that they literally are unable to satisfy those basic needs for shelter and nourishment. So if a doctor or other witnesses would have testified that David's mental illness is so severe that he doesn't clothe himself, he doesn't bathe himself, he doesn't eat, he doesn't drink, he doesn't sleep, he sleeps outside, and, you know, this is a Langley County case in northern Wisconsin in the winter. If any of those things had been testified to at this hearing, this would be a totally different case.
Counsel, I just want to make sure I had a good understanding of the relationship between the legal conclusion, trial court findings, and the testimony and record as it stands, and what we're supposed to do with that. Here the trial court made almost no findings of fact relevant to the dangerousness. It just essentially rendered a legal conclusion that he was dangerous, so far as I can tell. We don't have any specific findings that sort of delineate things that would support that. Of course, I don't see anything in the statute necessarily that says trial courts have to make a bunch of findings prerequisite to making a legal determination either. And so are we free as a court that's attempting to do this de novo legal analysis to read the record and then, I think as Melanie L. puts it, draw reasonable inferences therefrom in order to connect the dots and see whether that standard is met? Is that the invitation, I think, that you're giving us as well, and just saying that's not met here? Is that the appropriate analytical framework?
Yeah, and that we're not contesting, and that's been our position all along. That the legal standard, this whether there was clear and convincing evidence to meet the statutory standards of dangerousness that are at issue here, is a legal question. So while I think it would be helpful if this court were to say something or require circuit courts to make specific findings, that's not what we're asking. I don't think that's necessary. So all we're saying is that, yeah, I mean, I agree that the court in this case made literally no factual findings about dangerousness or why the doctor or why the court was concluding from the evidence that was in the record at the hearing that David was a danger to himself. The court found that he was delusional and that the delusions would come back if he wasn't under treatment. And
right.
We're not contesting those issues.
Does the trial court, in making its determination, or do we kind of get a... I mean, there was no identification of which standard was met, as Justice Bradley's question sort of suggests. Which, I mean, AM is sort of the vehicle by which you incorporate these other standards, right? But it doesn't seem typical to me, and I did a little look back at some other cases, that There's much of an effort on a regular basis to identify which other dangerousness standard is actually met that renders somebody a proper subject for treatment. Do trial courts have to do that? Is that something that you would advise us to and to tell them to make clear? What do you think about that?
Sure, and I guess the one thing I'll be somewhat hesitant to say for sure, because I know they're either having cases decided recently or there's petitions for review pending, I think, on that very issue, whether it's either required or required necessary for circuit courts to do that, to be specific. There was recently a Court of Appeals decision about, you know, whether the jury has to be unanimous on which of the standards. So to some extent, I think it would be helpful. I just don't think it's necessary in this case, and it's not addressed by this case. You know, my argument has been all along that that the evidence is simply insufficient on any of the standards of dangerousness that were, you know, that were put forth or that are at issue. So yeah, it is primarily this this recommitment standard, which, well, I think this court did say in Portage County versus JWK that it has to be linked back to one of the standards of dangerousness. Otherwise, we're just talking about some colloquial or some, you know it when you see it standard that just can't be, isn't the standard that's required to protect the due process rights of these individuals in these cases, which comes from the Supreme Court. So, I think the court, thinking back to your original question about, how does this court review cases like this, or how should courts, the Court of Appeals review these cases? We're looking at the evidence that's in the record at this hearing, and even when the circuit court, even if it would be better for the circuit court to make specific findings and explain itself, I think what this court can do is just look at the evidence that is in the record, which we're not contesting, what the doctor said. Whether or not it meets a legal standard is a question of law for this court or any appellate court to review on its own.
Following up on that, I note that the order of extension of commitment, unlike a lot of court documents that we see, simply has the court finds in bold, talking now about the pre-printed form, which I'm finding on appendix page 159 of the I, in contrast, note on page 161 the order for involuntary medication and treatment. And I see there that the form in bold says the court finds and concludes. And then, of course, have the court orders something. The contrast to me is heightened because sometimes we struggle with what's the difference between a finding of fact and a conclusion of law. If you're talking about de novo review here, whether or not the facts support the legal conclusions, what are the conclusions of law that you believe were not met here?
I think the court form and the court's order, the conclusion of law that he's dangerous, which is the basic question here, was found specifically.
Yes, and that's exactly what you're getting at. That's what I'm trying to focus on. For instance, on the order of extension of commitment, the court finds dangerous that he's. In sub 2, that the grounds exist dangerousness because the subject evidences behavior with one or more of the standards under, and then it has cites to what follow. Is the court saying that the subject is dangerousness? Is dangerous, rather, because of behavior that's evidenced, etc., is dangerous. Is that a finding of fact or conclusion of law there?
I think it's a finding of law or conclusion of law. If to the extent that the court, and I'll admit that the court in its finding after it found that he was, that David was delusional, so you know, after he found that he was mentally ill, found that he was, you know, or made a statement that David was dangerous, I think the court said it was finding that he was dangerous. So that's, to the extent that that's a finding of fact, and I agree that it's sometimes, and I think in this case, it's difficult to sort of separate exactly where the finding of fact is separate from the finding of law or the conclusion of law that it's, you know, that is at issue here. So the court found...
Please, go ahead.
Sure. So the court found that he was dangerous. That only matters in the legal sense in terms of whether it meets the statutory standard of dangerousness, which is reviewed de novo.
That's exactly it. It's reviewed de novo, I think. Because although the court finds dangerousness, a conclusion is like an opinion. A conclusion or opinions are not, generally speaking, facts, right? And so the conclusion or the opinion that someone is dangerous may be based on underlying facts, but it in of itself is not a historical fact.
Am I right or wrong on that?
I mean, that's the way I see it, but I'm testing it with you.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that, and I think to some extent it, you know, it hasn't been fleshed out significantly in the briefs because we're not arguing about whether it's a finding of fact or whether it's a conclusion of law. I think all agree that it's ultimately a legal question of whether all of the evidence that was introduced by the county meets that legal standard.
As I understand, if you're done, Ann.
Sure.
Okay. I understood your argument to be the form used and the findings of the form are the correct legal language, but the facts to support the legal determinations of dangerousness are not in the record. So that finding has to have something to support it. And relying on the government and relying on your family for financial and other assistance is not a sufficient factual basis to conclude that someone is dangerous.
Yes, I would agree.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I had your argument correctly.
Yes. So I guess the only thing I want to add at this point is that to some extent it's been argued just essentially on its face that this is what the doctor's conclusion was. This is the basis for the doctor's conclusion, and let's examine that. And I think it's worth noting, I guess partially why I think this is a somewhat unique case is that I've reviewed a handful of these cases, not all of them, so I'm not claiming to know how circuit courts generally do this or on a daily basis do this with every case, but I've seen lots of decisions and circuit court findings where they simply do, and doctor testimony, where it simply does repeat, these magic words or these, important words from the statute, and that's all there is. There's no explanation for the underlying basis for the doctor's conclusion, and, while I think that would be problematic in and of itself because it leaves the court guessing, it leaves everybody guessing what the actual basis or whether there's a factual basis for the conclusion. I think it also causes courts to have concern that, should we really be invalidating, a commitment order because the doctor wasn't asked enough questions? And then maybe defense counsel or adversary counsel should be, it should be their responsibility to, if there is an issue with the underlying opinion, to draw out that testimony.
If we are applying sub D, which requires evidence of behavior that he is unable to satisfy basic needs for nourishment, medical care, shelter, or safety, what about the testimony from Dr. Coates that I'm sure his parents would appreciate him receiving medication and being under treatment while he's living in their home? I think it would be very difficult for them to house him in a delusional psychotic state. Would that satisfy D?
No, I don't think it satisfies the statutory standard, Your Honor. I think, you know, I think the doctor could have tested. I don't dispute that the doctor testified to that. It just doesn't meet the statutory standard. I think, it would be a separate issue of whether or not David obtaining, if we're talking specifically about the shelter requirement of that inability to take care of oneself or, obtain basic human needs. If he has housing, but it would be difficult for his family, I think that goes to explain why the doctor believes he should be, he should be compliant with his medication and treatment. That's not the same thing as saying he is dangerous under the statute or as required by due process to involuntarily commit somebody against their will. So the fact that it might be difficult for his family if he's living with them, not on his medication, I think that if those were the facts, this would be a different case. But that's simply not what we have here. So we're not saying that that this standard can never be met or can even never be met just with doctor testimony, but being a difficult family member does not make somebody dangerous to anybody, to themselves, which the fourth standard concerns danger to oneself, not.
Well, if he became so difficult that they could not house him safely, they could not take care of him in their home, rendering him homeless, that would be a danger to him, wouldn't it?
Yes, I know my red light is on.
You can answer the question.
Yeah. I mean, I think there could be innumerable additional testimony in a case like this that, that could have or might have been, if it had been admitted and testified to, might meet that statutory standard. I wouldn't concede that David being homeless means that he's unable to satisfy his basic needs. There are homeless shelters. There are ways for people who are homeless to meet those basic needs for human care that doesn't require or doesn't allow the government to involuntarily commit somebody. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Robin James Stowe appearing on behalf of Langlade County. As the Langlade County Corporation Counsel, I also represented the interests of the public at the recommitment hearing for DJW on July 18, 2017.
How can it be that when you rely on the government and you rely on your financial and other assistance, that equates to dangerousness?
That argument is being framed by opposing counsel. The public, the interest of the public, once the petition for extension is received from our Department of Community Programs, we set the hearing, we send out a notification of rights to the patient, and I'd like to refer to DJW as the patient, if I may. In that notice that's received, it lists all four dangerousness criteria under the statute. A through D. In addition to that,
it's one thing when you have someone who's mentally ill. Let's just leave that part out of it because I don't think people are contesting that. But when you have someone who functions without that extra thing, even if they're functioning in a way, you see them walking down the street every single day, back and forth, and it's really unusual behavior. But they don't do anything to themselves, and they don't do anything to anybody else, and they don't make any threats in that regard. And they put on their clothes, and they're not in the middle of a snowstorm out there naked or, different things like that could cause you to believe that they're dangerous to themselves, right? Or someone else. when you don't have that extra thing, just because someone relies on things or lives a different way than maybe you would want to or other people in society would want, that doesn't make them, they don't meet the legal standard.
I would agree, but we're talking about someone that is already under a commitment. This is an extension of commitment. So we're talking about, with the Portage County versus JWK case, the attendant consequence to the patient if treatment is... That's what we're talking about here. If you look at the findings of the circuit court, I would argue that the circuit court was latching on to 5120, hopefully I'm getting the site right, 1C, impaired judgment is what was emphasized by the circuit court, not an inability to satisfy basic living needs. That was something that was raised specifically or characterized specifically by opposing counsel. The other thing I would mention is if you look at the transcript, because that's all we have here, is
the... Is the impaired judgment relying on the government and relying on your family?
No, it's the current condition of delusions, which again was remarked upon by the circuit court judge. Significant disturbances in his perception. Again, these were all noted by the circuit court judge. And again, the attendant consequence to where that would lead.
I'm not trying to be overly critical, but I've probably had too many of these cases.
I feel like
all these conjure up different cases that I've had in the past. And, you know, there are differences when you can quantifiably know that there's something extra that creates the dangerousness, even if someone's walking around almost completely delusional, but they know how to, when to cross the street, when not to. They can do a lot of things, even though they do it differently than you or I might do. They don't qualify for commitment because of that dangerous element that is missing.
And to be clear, I'm not arguing the lost employment, the disability benefits, and reliance on family. Again, that's raised by opposing counsel in this challenge. If you look at the transcript, this really came about on cross-examination with counsel at that hearing, cross-examining Dr. Coates, asking for specifics. And what do we know about the recommitment standard is that's what it's all about. There is no recent acts, pattern of behavior. Why? Because they're receiving the benefit of treatment. But that's what was asked of Dr. Coates. Dr. Coates, in his report, gave his opinion through his testimony that if treatment were withdrawn, this patient would satisfy all four elements of dangerousness, all four. So when he was questioned...
A through D, just to be clear?
A through D.
Okay.
A through D. So then when he's being asked questions on cross-examination, he's asked for, again, specific examples. If you feel he's a danger to himself, and the focus was really on the last 6 months because he's already under that initial commitment. So when he's giving this, he's saying, well, he lost his employment. He applied for and received disability benefits. He's relying on his family for care. That is all while he's under a treatment order. It has nothing to do with the attendant consequences to him if this treatment order is withdrawn. He does talk more about that also.
And that's the challenge with these recommitment proceedings, right? Because the person is receiving treatment, and so we really can't look at their recent acts, and JWK spoke to that. So we are dealing within the realm of what could happen, and that's what the doctor, that's all the doctor can testify to, right?
Yes. And what's odd about these recommitment proceedings is that the process in the statute is unclear. It doesn't require an examination by a doctor. You're skipping Section 9 going, I think it's 10 through 13 on a recommitment. The recommitment standard, 5121AM, is based on a review of the treatment record. Who conducts that review? It's an independent medical expert appointed by the court. That's who does the review of the treatment record. In addition, with that court order, because it's the standard court order, the medical expert is supposed to conduct or try to conduct a personal examination, review the treatment record, and file a report with the court, which the subject individual also gets a copy of that report before the hearing.
Are you saying that all the doctor has to say is he meets A through D and that's it?
What I'm saying is that when they receive the notice of hearing rights, We don't know where this is going to take us. We don't have the doctor's report yet. Then we have the doctor's report, which is filed usually just a matter of days before the hearing.
I'm familiar with all that. I've been in court and I've done
this.
So the question I'm asking is, without specific, you said the only specific examples were given as to D, but the doctor said A through D, so we're not focusing on D. He said A, B, and C, and because he said it, that's enough. And that's what I'm hearing you say.
No, what I'm saying is that in his opinion, if treatment were withdrawn, all of those dangerousness criteria would be satisfied. In my direct examination, I asked him, is there one that you feel is more...
I have a follow-up to...
Let him finish.
Can he finish, and then I have a specific follow-up. Go ahead.
So I asked him if there was one that was more likely than another, and no, he felt that they're all likely. He did give examples to each one throughout his testimony. For example, danger to self. He indicated that if treatment were withdrawn because of the state of his condition, he mentioned that there's a greater statistical likelihood that someone who suffers from schizophrenia may commit suicide.
There's more likelihood, but nothing specific to him, right? I didn't see anything specific except for those sub D, and I'm going to direct you to the Court of Appeals case because his initial commitment was appealed.
Yes.
And it was found by the Court of Appeals that the commitment fell under D. So you're telling me the initial commitment under sub D, now he's on a recommitment, and you're going to say that the doctor can just say it's A, B, C, or D without giving any specific examples.
What I'm saying is that the findings of the circuit court, my argument is if there's one of the standards that we're connecting 1 a.m. to one of those four standards, it would be, in my opinion, it would be 1C. It would be
even
impaired judgment.
Even though he committed under 1D initially?
Initially under 1D with the initial commitment?
Correct.
Yes, I don't believe that when you're recommitting someone, there could be any of those standards are in play. All of the standards are in play.
Sure, but you have to have some example of how. So you don't even have the... When you're starting with a commitment under one of those standards, you at least have a basis set, right? And then they receive treatment for a period of 6 months. It's the same. You still have to prove the current dangerousness, but you can do so differently. We've said that. But you have to base it on something. And so you can't, you're not basing it on what the initial commitment was on. You're saying it's under C, but what do you have to show that it's under C? Where does it come from? It doesn't come from anything that was initially the basis of the commitment.
We're talking about the first commitment?
Right.
Or this recommitment, the first commitment?
No, the reason he's there. We're reviewing
right.
the recommitment.
Yes.
He's there under D. I mean, that's what the court said, that in light of the circuit court's factual findings, we are satisfied that clear and convincing evidence showed David was dangerous under the terms of 5120 sub 1 sub A 2D. I mean, I thought until you made this argument right now, we're talking about D, and you're coming up and saying we're talking about C. So where is the C? What shows that he's dangerous under C?
Dr. Coates, in his testimony, testified that the patient, his judgment is still impaired. The treatment is working to the extent that he was, under the initial commitment, he was inpatient for one month of the first 6 months he was inpatient. At that time, he was hearing, this is testimony of Dr. Coates, he was hearing voices, auditory and visual hallucinations on a daily basis. Then he's outpatient for about 4 months, and Dr. Coates examines him a second time for this recommitment proceeding. He's still hearing voices, hearing the devil 4 months ago, hearing other voices as recently as 2 months ago, so okay. The treatment is working.
Okay. Treatment's working.
Yes.
He's going to hear voices.
Right.
Give you that. Where is the substantial probability of physical impairment or injury to himself or others or other individuals? That's
again,
C.
If we're searching for a specific act or a pattern, that's not required for the recommitment statute. That is predictive in nature and it's conditional in nature. And if you can satisfy that AM standard, you are linking it to the other dangerousness standards, but like I said, it's predictive and it's conditional.
Right,
and if you could prove that, it's still current dangerousness.
Yeah. So what is the prediction specific to this patient?
Okay. What Dr. Coates also testified to about what would happen if the patient is no longer receiving treatment. He indicated that the schizophrenia, these symptoms would take their course.
Right. He'd manifest schizophrenia.
Correct. But as far as the danger, he talks about someone who would then act out on these delusions, act out on them, and when being commanded by voices to do something inappropriately. So the danger there is for someone who has impaired judgment, is not cooperating with treatment, is indicating that he will not comply with treatment if the treatment is withdrawn, is still symptomatic, and the independent medical expert appointed by the court is telling us that if treatment were withdrawn, symptoms are going to exacerbate, and he's going to be right back inpatient.
Right. So yes. He'll go right back to where
right
he was
back.
Before. Okay. So what was it about the before picture that suggested that the standard in C would be met, a substantial probability of physical impairment or injury?
Could you state that again, your question,
sure.
Please?
So I'm basically following up on Justice. So you're saying now that the recommitment is based on C rather than B. Okay, fair enough.
But
I don't see any.
Hmm? That, again, just to clarify, the public, we were prepared to argue all four standards. I'm reacting to the findings of the circuit court. If we want to pin it to what is the circuit court finding,
yeah.
I don't see D there. I see C.
Okay.
I see impaired judgment.
All right. That's fine.
Yeah.
You're relying on C. So we'll go to C. And there it says that there needs to be a substantial probability of physical impairment or injury to himself or other individuals. And so what was there about the before picture, before his schizophrenia was controlled, before the delusions were controlled? What was there that suggested a substantial probability of physical impairment or injury to himself or others?
Are we asking about what led to the initial commitment?
I'm asking you to tell me,
yep.
On the recommitment, you're going back to see if you're saying if treatment is withdrawn, he'll qualify for recommitment under C. That's your fear. What tells you that?
What tells me that? Well, C is impaired judgment.
Right.
So you're talking about, again, it's predictive, conditional, that substantial,
yes.
Likelihood based on the treatment record. Treatment record indicates, and from the testimony of the doctor, his judgment is still impaired.
Let me shorten this up for you.
Okay.
I get that.
Yep.
But after you establish all of that, you have to show a substantial probability of physical impairment or injury. What makes you fear that?
Also testified to by the doctor, there is a history there of property damage and some aggressive behavior. Again, he didn't get into specifics about that. And these were situations that led to his initial commitment. My understanding is we're reviewing the sufficiency of the evidence at the recommitment hearing, which is a different standard.
Is exacerbation of schizophrenia and the associated delusions and hallucinations physical impairment?
I would argue that if you look at the totality of all the evidence there, that there is the predictive nature of this, because that's what you're asking.
Let me tell you the reason I'm asking, because I'm looking at some testimony of Dr. Coates. He said, without proper treatment and the illness exacerbates, like you stop giving a guy diabetic medicine to control his blood sugar, the blood sugar would get out of control. It's the same thing. So I hear Dr. Coates saying that schizophrenia is a physical illness, like diabetes is a physical illness. Do you agree with that under the language of the statute?
Well, I'm not a medical doctor. We're relying on specialists in the field of psychiatry to give these opinions to the court as far as diagnosed mental illness, in this case schizophrenia.
Was there any evidence that contradicted that statement by Dr. Coates?
No. Matter of fact, there was no objections at all to any of the testimony from Dr. Coates, no objections to his ability to testify as an expert.
So is it sufficient for commitment to be delusional and have hallucinations? Is that sufficient all by itself?
No, not on its own, but if you were talking about the attendant consequences to someone if treatment were withdrawn,
yeah,
and the process that we're using relies on an independent medical expert. We're not using the treatment team. There's no treatment bias. This independent expert has no stake in the outcome. So they're doing a personal examination. They're reviewing the record.
I get all that.
Okay.
What I'm trying to figure out is, what is the basis you're using for the recommitment? So you say that schizophrenia with delusions and hallucinations is not by itself sufficient. But it seems that you're saying that it's sufficient for recommitment.
The attendant consequences to the patient if treatment were withdrawn. The medical expert is testifying and serving as a credible basis for the findings of the circuit court that the attendant consequences are he's going to be hearing voices again commanding him to
do. That's not sufficient to get him committed in the first place, right? AM is there to say, look, if we withdraw the treatment, would he be back in a position where he could be committed on an original basis? Right? That's what AM is there for. So you got to point to under AM is, we withdraw the treatment, here's how he could be committed under A through E as an original matter. And you've already told me that, that schizophrenia with hallucinations and delusions is not sufficient by itself to be committed as an original matter. So you can't go to that as for basis for recommitment. You got to have something in addition to that, right? So what's the addition?
The addition of, are we speaking, your question is dangerousness? What is the prediction?
Yeah, everything we're talking about here is dangerousness. How are you going to satisfy the dangerousness standard? It can't be satisfied just by being schizophrenic, so you can't refer just to that. So what's the plus in addition to schizophrenia that gets you recommitment?
The plus is that in his circumstances, and the facts are different in each of these cases, in his circumstance, if treatment is withdrawn, the symptoms are going to exacerbate. He's going to be right back to where he started, perhaps in a month inpatient, which is more restrictive to him. But I, what the doctors
what
indicate...
That, what does that mean, yeah, right back where you started? Tell me what that means in terms of dangerousness.
In terms of dangerousness, as testified to the doctor, is he saying that the prediction is danger to others based on someone acting out on these delusions. And these delusions are going to be heightened without treatment.
Do we have anything to indicate that DJW is more likely to act out his delusions than anyone else with schizophrenia?
If you look at the treatment record, there were... in the treatment record, there's a reason why he received treatment in the first place. So
he has delusions and hallucinations.
There was a dangerousness component also, obviously, in the initial commitment.
And that commitment was, as Justice Dallet was mentioning, that was under D, is that right?
Well, I don't have that record with me today. My understanding, again, because this was briefed on this transcript of this recommitment hearing, my understanding is it wasn't limited just to that finding. I don't recall what box was checked by the circuit court.
All right. So let's
in the initial.
So without regard to whether it was A through D, what was the dangerousness aspect that got him committed in the first place?
The dangerousness aspect in the initial commitment, if you recall from the testimony of Dr. Coates, it started with a settlement agreement, a 90-day hold open. And again, he has a history of not cooperating with treatment. So he violated the terms of that settlement agreement, was rehospitalized,
So the commitment was based on a violation, not on a statutory showing of dangerousness.
The original commitment, and again, now we're straying from this record, but there was record.
You're telling me is that we need, for the recommitment dangerousness, we need to go back to the original commitment to find the dangerousness element there. And now what you're telling me is that there was not really a finding of dangerousness for the commitment. It was based on a violation of a settlement agreement.
My understanding of the initial commitment record was that there was other acts such as property damage, aggressive behavior.
Is that the reason that the circuit court imposed the commitment order? Or was it because of a violation of that agreement?
The violation of the agreement just sets the matter for further proceedings.
Okay. And so what was the dangerousness element that got him committed?
As I recall, it was aggressive behavior. I believe there was some threats to others. And again, I thought it was just this record, but it's in the,
you're
court.
You're relying on this,
right? Right, sure.
Commitment. So it's got to be a part of this record.
And those threats to others were found not to have happened, correct? That was improperly relied on, and that is talked about in this record.
Well,
so you can't really rely on something that didn't happen.
What I mentioned when that was being admitted into evidence is my concern that where is that in the context of the entire record? I think if one, and again, it's the doctor that's examining this entire record, that's what we're relying on, I would argue that there's evidence in the entire treatment record about threats to others.
Counsel, is C the only subsection that you are relying on right now, or are you relying on all of them, or which ones are you arguing on? I couldn't tell from your brief.
I would rely on the testimony of Dr. Coates, the independent expert.
I know factually what you rely on. I'm really, obviously, we need to make a de novo determination that the facts match the law, right?
Correct.
So you need to identify A through D, which one you're relying on. We will need to identify that. Which ones are you relying on, which ones are you not? I hear you arguing C. Are you arguing any others?
No, I'm arguing impaired judgment.
So just C?
Just C.
Okay.
To support the findings of the circuit court being consistent in matching the testimony.
Let's focus. I need to focus on what this case is about. First of all, I don't think it's about if you live at home with your parents, you should be mentally committed because you kids, you have to form a line, right? And it's not about if you lose your job or even go on disability benefits. That, you know, those focuses, those different points of emphasis in this case seem to me to be more attention-getting. I mean, certainly, if we would say, as in my opinion anyway, we would say that you meet a dangerousness requirement and you can continue and you can be committed, loss of liberty because of losing your job, living at home, getting disability benefits, which emphasize you can't be working. I mean, that raises such a red flag. That's not what this case is about, because if it were about it, it would be so contrary to U.S. Supreme Court precedent that we don't even need to look further than a couple of cases, period. So what is this case about? I also sense that it's not about, but correct me if I'm wrong, it's not about the initial hearing. Let me ask, just to nuance that, what, if any, import does the initial commitment hearing have on the threshold question of needing to be continued treatment or if treatment were withdrawn? So is there some kind of nexus? I mean, obviously, you wouldn't be recommitted if you weren't initially committed, but I'm talking about analytical nexus.
First of all, as you pointed out, the lost employment, et cetera, the circuit court did not base its findings on that. As far as using, let's say, exclusively the grounds that resulted in the initial commitment, if you're going to be using that as the interest of the public, that's just going to end up in endless commitments. If that's all you're using, you're going to keep pointing back to what led to that initial commitment. As I said, the process for recommitment, the patient is notified of all of the standards, and then we take that evidence where it takes us through the independent expert.
Under AM, because he was originally committed, and we're looking at a recommitment, we're looking at the treatment record, right? Does that encompass the treatment record going back to the original commitment, or is it the more recent treatment record?
Dr. Galley's testimony, he indicated that the treatment record for the patient goes back to 2014, although really the only thing he testified to was the time between his two examinations, one in January and one in June, so about a five-month period of time, is really what he was focusing on.
Why are we only focusing on the doctor's testimony here? He also testified in this case.
Yes.
You know, he said, I would have a place to stay. I've never had an issue with food, clothing, housing, self-hygiene. To what extent is that relevant for us? And again, this is an interesting case, and it's oftentimes we have trial courts that don't make factual findings here. So, and as we discussed earlier with your opposing counsel, so we're supposed to look at the record. We're supposed to connect the dots. What do we do when you have some, you know, you have the doctor saying, this guy may not be able to take care of himself, and he says, yes, I can. What are we supposed to do with that when we're reviewing this at this level?
Well, what the circuit court did is it weighed all the evidence, and it found that the doctor's testimony was more credible, and it reflected that in its decision. It reflected that I believe that what the doctor is telling me, telling us with regards to the danger if treatment is withdrawn, the circuit court basically reiterated the testimony of the doctor in those regards. I don't see anything in the circuit court findings other than the fact I think that the circuit court indicated that this is someone who doesn't believe or denies he has a mental illness, has indicated that he's not going to continue with treatment if the treatment order is removed.
Just briefly want to kick the horse that Justice Kelly was working on for a little bit, on C a little bit. The injury to himself or others in sub C, are you alleging that? Are you alleging that there would be substantial probability that he would injure himself or others if treatment were withdrawn, or physical impairment, or both?
Through the testimony of Dr. Coates, it would be more of a danger to himself, because that's what Dr. Coates emphasized. And on that basis, it would be a danger to himself because of him acting out on delusions.
So physical of injury or physical impairment?
The doctor didn't specify.
Shouldn't he? So,
well, again, the concern here is that this is predictive. We're predicting this through the testimony of the doctor. What are the attendant consequences if treatment were withdrawn? The doctor in his testimony said that there's a danger to self.
Isn't there a concern that it's predictive and what the doctor was relying on was general statistics? Isn't that a concern? You could say this about anybody who is schizophrenic, who refuses medication, that they are subject, who suffers from delusions, that they are subject to having delusions if they don't take their medication, and that their schizophrenia could get worse, just like a diabetic could get worse if they don't take their sugar. Do we force people to take, or their insulin, do we force people to do that? I mean, isn't that what the problem is here?
I don't believe if the totality of the testimony of Dr. Coates was that he was basing it solely on statistical evidence. He provided a clinical assessment. He did a examination.
He suffers from schizophrenia, right.
And noting
and delusions.
Different disturbances, symptoms, and information that was actually reported to him from the patient. So it's a combination of his medical opinion to a reasonable degree of medical certainty about this specific individual with their specific symptoms, and then he also relayed some statistical correlation to that prediction.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
So is it your client's position that if we reverse the order below, the decision below, that he will respond if his condition deteriorates as he did in 2014 when he checked himself in, and again 2016? When he checked himself in for assistance due to his delusions.
Sure, yeah, I think David testified very clearly at this extension hearing that in 2014 he voluntarily sought mental health treatment when he was, I think at that time it was depression and just some sort of mental health issue. He was diagnosed with depression initially in 2014. In 2016, he voluntarily sought help. He sought help at an inpatient facility because there was a long wait list to get a counselor. So he sought help. He was diagnosed with schizophrenia. He decided that he wanted to leave, and he was held there involuntarily, and that initiated this settlement agreement and his original commitment.
He's been living with his parents, but he has been seeing a counselor, correct?
I don't think that's what the record shows. I think he says that he does meet with his counselor. I think he was asked whether he meets monthly or more frequently than that. I think that's what he testified to at the hearing, and that I have to admit that he said that he probably or might not continue treatment or medication. I mean, that's the entire reason why we're here. If he was willing to do exactly what his doctors and the county wanted of him, then they wouldn't need to involuntarily commit him, or they wouldn't think that they needed to or think that they could. So, yes, he testified that he has sought voluntary treatment in the past when his mental health issues were a concern, just as we would hope for the best of any of these cases. The question is just simply whether or not he would become dangerous, or whether or not he is dangerous sufficient to involuntarily commit him.
My question really went to, and I thought I may have misread it because I read the whole thing over again, that he was going to a counselor while he was under commitment. He lives with his mom and dad, so the commitment really just involves intramuscular shot once every 3 weeks of Haldol, right? But I thought he was also seeing his counselor, and I'll go back and read the record.
I think he did testify to seeing his counselor. I think
he
there was
said
some.
I'm looking at it now. He said, sure. Yeah, he gave the name of the counselor, and how often do you see him? Once a month.
Sure.
And then he said, would you continue seeing him if there was no commitment? And he said, I might.
Sure.
Okay, so I think, all right, fine. That may or may not help my thought process, but thank you.
Sure. And I guess just to touch on, I think, where I started my presentation, that, and I think this gets to Justice Bradley's question about why are we here. Just this brief side note, I wouldn't be raising the issue of loss of employment, loss of housing, or obtaining disability benefits if that wasn't what Dr. Coates testified to on and on and on during his testimony. And that was, I think the record's very clear that that was Dr. Coates' basis for thinking that David would become dangerous. That's why David's dangerous, because he can't take care of himself.
Counsel, can you just address briefly my question to your opposing counsel as well, that we have competing testimony potentially. What we're supposed to do with that if the trial court did make explicit factual findings?
I think the standard of review here is clear that this court, if there's no factual findings about a specific contested factual issues at a hearing like this, then this court reviews the record de novo to see whether or not the evidence meets the standard. And to the extent that the standard here, just to be clear, is clear and convincing evidence, if it's one witness saying one thing and another witness saying another thing, these cases are obviously very fact dependent, but if it's if equal weight is given to that testimony and that's what we have, then it's at least an issue whether or not that meets generally doesn't.
But for the court to order recommitment, equal weight couldn't have been given to both people testifying.
I don't understand the question specifically.
The court had to have believed the doctor over the committee. If the court issued the order that the court issued and the court made the findings that the court made, the legal conclusions.
He found the doctor more credible, I believe.
I think that's fair to assume from the finding and from the testimony. I think the issue is David wasn't, and we're not contesting what the doctor said. And to some extent, David didn't necessarily disagree with a whole lot of what the doctor said, other than the specific facts about he would have housing, or he would, David testified to working. But the issue is just whether or not that evidence meets the standard. And I guess just to briefly touch on, since we're talking about essentially C and D at the recommitment stage, I think the county has the same issue on both of those standards, that they have clear, we're not contesting the testimony about mental illness. simply contesting, or we're simply discussing whether or not there he would suffer those consequences. And the statute is very clear that it's physical injury, it's physical impairment. D specifically talks about, you know, essentially immediate death or serious physical injury. And that's what the evidence doesn't meet in this case. Thank you.
Well, thank you both for an interesting case in combination with the one that we heard at the first argument. We are going to adjourn now until our 1:30 case. Justice Dallet will be out chat with the high school students if they can stick around for a while. We are adjourned.